Blog Talk Radio.
Guys, welcome to Movie Geeks United. This Wednesday night, we're done with our 80s series, and we're back to the same old Movie Geeks United.
Wow, that was just, I don't know what to say. Let's talk to Chris. We haven't had Chris on in a while, so let's let Chris chime in.
Hey, Chris.
What's up, guys? How we doing?
We're doing all right.
Hey. Actually, Jerry, you wanted to say something?
I wanted to say something, and I'll shut up for the rest of the show. But no, this Saturday in Baltimore, Maryland, at the historic Senator Theater, our friend Francis Abbey's second film, Six Non-Smokers, is having its exclusive East Coast screening. And all you have to do is email, let me just get the address here, the email address, screening@sixnonsmokers.com, and you will get in to the film. It doesn't cost anything, but there is you can give a donation for the next film, Conquering the Rose, that they're working on this summer. And that's at 6:30, and the movie starts at 8 o'clock, and that's this Saturday. If you're in the Baltimore area, you know, come on by.
Baltimore, Maryland, Six Non-Smokers.
I haven't been in Baltimore in a long time.
So, like, Dean just said hi, Jamie, in the chat room, and I wasn't thinking as I was typing. I just typed hi, Jamie, back to him.
Wow.
So it's like at 8 o'clock or something?
8 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. There's, like, a pre-screening party, and it should be a lot of fun. There's going to be a lot of people there, and I've worked on the film a couple of days, and it was a good experience, and I just think it's very exciting because we don't have a lot of comedies in the area that people make. I mean, we have a lot of, like, documentaries and a lot of industrial videos and a lot of political stuff, but we don't get a lot of comedies in this area, so this is something really to look forward to.
Hey, what about John Waters?
Well, John, I was talking more on the indie scene. John Waters is, like, you know, he's like the man. He's like, I'm just talking about on a locally, like, you know, locally, you know, small scale. We don't get that a lot. No, John Waters, you know, he's in a class by himself. I was actually hoping we could get John Waters to do something like advertising or something.
I have long said to Jamie that John Waters would be a dream guest of mine.
I will
be honest, I don't even particularly like John Waters' movies. I just like John Waters because he's such an interesting interview every time I've ever seen him.
He's a great, you know, storyteller.
I submitted to him for this in connection to this book that he just wrote, Role Models.
Yeah. He's great. I just met him on a smaller scale. I put John Waters is such a household name, a brand name.
He's iconic now. Yeah.
I just met him on a local thing. You know, we get a lot of things that you get around here, you know, a lot of political stuff, especially in an election year, is a lot of the work. So it's always nice when people are making, like, short narratives or feature narratives. It's always a good thing.
Hey, I think we have a topic, a film that all three of us can discuss this week because all three of us have actually seen it.
What film
is it? Wow.
Yeah, and I'm talking about Toy Story 3.
Oh yeah, cool.
Oh, okay.
We haven't talked about it yet on the show because we've been away since it opened. So I was excited about Toy Story 3. I called my older brother and I said, hey, dude, you want to come to the movies with me tonight? And he said, sure. What are we seeing? I said, Toy Story 3. And he said, what? So I tracked him to this kid's movie. And I went at nighttime because I was thinking, man, I just want to go where there's not screaming children all over the place. And there wasn't, except for one sitting right next to me. But I still really, really liked it. I mean, I was I would probably not have seen it at the theater because I don't see every movie that comes out in the theater, and I usually wait till DVD, unless I had read some of these reviews, like the review of Owen Gleiberman in EW that said this is one of the most moving films I've ever seen. And, you know, it was glowing, and every review essentially, outside of you know who, was glowing.
And I do know who you mean.
Yeah. So I thought, yeah, this sounds like my cup of tea, and I've always liked the Toy Story movies. I thought it was really strong. I thought it was emotional, even though I didn't cry at it or anything. But I did think it was surprisingly dark. That's what I've been going back and forth with Chris about a couple of days ago. Accurately so. I mean, it wasn't like completely out of place because it essentially is about, in a way, the death of childhood. You know,
it is. It's unavoidable. I mean,
yeah. So go ahead. You guys' thoughts on it, either one of you.
Chris, you want to go first, or?
No, I agree with everything Jamie just said. I don't even know if it's just about the death of childhood. I think the movie's a lot about death in general.
Mm-hmm.
I very much so, actually. And, I said that on Facebook, and people gave me some shit about spoilers. Obviously, no one dies in the movie.
No,
it's the theme of the movie. And by the way, it's not like Pixar is afraid to kill people. We all saw Up, so they'll only kill a character off. But, you know, this is not, the tone of this movie is not like Up. I think it's a better movie, actually. I was so taken aback by how into the movie I was, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Especially not only for a children's movie and for an animated movie, but also for a sequel, a part three, no less, you know. Like, I mean, it was a really, I don't know if I've ever seen a stronger third entry into a film series, really. Like, by three, usually, it doesn't matter what series you're talking about, whether it's The Godfather or Alien or anything. Like, usually they sort of peter off by the third one.
Yeah.
Not the case. I would argue that this is actually the most layered and most interesting of the three Toy Story movies. Because I remember very, very little from the first two. I remember liking them, but I don't remember feeling emotionally attached the way I did with this movie.
I think they had something to talk about, and that was the reason to make the third one.
It's unbelievable, but I have to say the last three Pixar movies are very emotionally involving. That's what I find so shocking. And I was not particularly looking forward to this in the way I wanted to see it, but, you know, within the first 5 minutes, you're, like, really sucked in to it. And it is about death. I mean, the daycare center is the equivalent of an old age home. I mean, that point is, like, made very clear. And, you know, no one wants to go to a fucking retirement community. I don't care who you are. That's, like, the end. That's, like, the beginning of the end. So there's a lot of these things it has in common with Up. I think it's just Up. I mean, I like Up a lot. And it's just, it's bleak at times. It's very bleak. But this is, I think, just as bleak in some ways. But then there's that third act really, everything comes together. There is some hope. There is this and that. But I am astounded by how much death and how much emotion you have in these films, where most of the, like, I'm sorry, like, real life movie or whatever, live action movies don't display an ounce of this. Like,
yeah, well, no movie has dealt with death in this way since Up, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, that really, you don't get, death is not, I mean, it's a character in movies. Like, people die in movies very often,
yeah.
But there's not a lot of movies that deal very straightforwardly with death the way that Up and Toy Story 3 do. And you touched on something interesting that I want to talk about, which is the third act that works so well in Toy Story 3, that was the one thing that was missing from Up, in my opinion. Like, I loved the first two-thirds of Up. I thought the movie was fantastic. In fact, I thought that was a problem because it was completely front-loaded with all the thoughtful material, and the final act of the movie was just nonstop action and very cartoony, which is fine, but it didn't come together the way that Toy Story 3 did. I mean, it really was wrapped up nicely, and it was very satisfying. It felt very complete at the end of the movie. I was not wanting for anything more. And someone, I forget who, but some reviewer said, thank God that they added on that blooper reel or whatever it was during the credits so that everyone could, you know, let the tears in their eyes dry. And I hate to admit that I was definitely getting a little bit misty at the end of Toy Story 3.
Yeah, I didn't expect that. I mean, I expected it, like I said, I wanted to see it, but it wasn't something I was clamoring for when I first heard about it.
Right.
And as I'm watching it, you're just like, wow. This is what's been missing from so many other movies lately.
Well, it's good. It's got the Pixar patent, you know, in their best stuff. It's got great writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's got wonderful staging. You know, people don't think that an animated movie is directed, but I mean it is. I mean, and some of these sequences are directed with as much ingenuity as a Spielberg sequence in some of these films. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're fast, they're energetic, they're inventive.
Yeah,
Toy Story 3 has it all. I mean, I was taken by the vocal performances in it, and
mm-hmm.
I was trying to place the Huggy Bear, the you know, the main guy in the daycare, the big bear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Lotso. And I was like, what is this?
I couldn't place him either.
Yeah, and then I looked him up. I was at Ned Beatty, and I still can't place Ned Beatty with that voice.
I know that caught me off guard too. I was like, "That's Ned Beatty? Wow!"
Yeah, it is a great movie,
and it's surprising too. Like, it wasn't predictable. It really wasn't. Like, I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, I didn't feel the turns of. I mean, obviously, you could feel a sort of a happy ending coming, and you do feel like there's going to be some. They're gonna get some sort of pleasure from their relationship with Andy and vice versa
mm-hmm.
again. But you don't know how that's going to happen. I really did not have any understanding. And what you're talking about the sequences, is so true. Like, there's so many sequences in this movie that are so well-directed and staged. Like, for instance, when they learn that they are in the caterpillar room as opposed to the butterfly room, and they don't know what that means, and the children are coming at the door. When those children finally bust through those doors and come in, there's about a minute and a half sequence of the chaos that takes
uh-huh.
place there. I mean, it's like
yes.
an action sequence from any movie that you would see, you know, you're certainly not going to get anything like that in Prince of Persia or in, you know, any of these other retarded
right.
action
yeah.
movies.
Yeah, I mean, you're just...
Theater. Like, that was probably the action sequence of the summer, like, I would think, you know?
yeah. Well, didn't you feel like that, speaking of Spielberg, that the train sequence in the beginning was, like, reminded me so much of The Last Crusade?
Yes,
very
yes.
much so. Even some of the shots, some of
yeah.
the camera movements.
The long
were
shot
exactly.
of the train and the ride,
yes.
and all that.
Very much so.
You know, and so I've read some criticism, not critical of the movie, but just, you know, positive criticism, comparing it to, like, saying that it's a Holocaust metaphor. I mean, people go, like,
a little bit
overboard with some of this stuff. But I guess it's unavoidable. We got to talk about, just mention briefly, Armand White's reaction.
You love to bring him up.
Is this valid or not? His main criticism of this one, he's critical of all Pixar movies because they're popular and well-loved, but his main criticism of this one is that it's 2 hours of product placement, where they're essentially, they're making a movie about toys to sell toys.
Well,
which,
okay.
I don't know. I haven't been to the kids' aisle, but do they sell these toys or these big toys?
That's the whole point. That, first of all, if it was maybe 1975, he might be onto something. But that's the whole point. Even when the first one came out, these toys were already toys from our childhood or the filmmaker's childhood.
Right.
They weren't really played with that much anymore. Yes, it's product placement in the 70s maybe, but that's a lazy criticism. While I disagree with Armand White 99% of the time, or let's say all the time, that's even for him, that's lazy criticism.
Yeah.
It is lazy, and you're right. Like, the only toys in the movie that are known toys are toys that have been around forever, things like Slinky and Mr. Potato Head and Etch-A-Sketch and Barbie. These things are selling anyway, and as for things that are new, like Woody and Buzz Lightyear, well, every animated movie has toys of their character, so that's nothing different here, you know? I mean, this is a retarded argument. Mm-hmm. Like, this guy hates everything that's popular, and he loves movies like Max Payne and
Or
Small
Jonah
Soldier
Hex.
Because, or Jonah
Transformers
Hex,
Transformers
right.
2... Which
Transformers 2.
And that's fine if I felt he really liked those movies, but since it's all to be contrarian, every single thing is to be
right.
And I, you know,
exactly.
It becomes, if he actually there was some consistency, and he actually said, if he actually pointed out something good or bad about these films, like something original in his critiques, I might go with him. But it just seems like he just wants to be a troublemaker, from what I can gather.
No, you can predict his reviews before they come out. Like, literally say, wow, that looks like a piece of shit. Guess who's going to love it? Wow, this one's really got a lot of good buzz. Guess who's going to hate it?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's ridiculous at this point. Like, I mean, it's obvious that he's just being contrary.
Yeah.
I now pronounce you, Chuck and Larry, as the Some Like It Hot of our generation.
That was just very frightening.
I tell people about his reviews and that aren't familiar with him, and all I hear is like laughter and sometimes stunned silence. It's just disbelief. Like, he's putting us on, right? No, he really panned Toy Story 3 in favor of Small Soldiers, Jonah Hex, and Transformers 2.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, look at me, I've got a different opinion than everybody else. It's a really good article in Vanity Fair this month about film criticism,
mm-hmm.
and the guy from Salon, for his name escapes me right now, and his recent comment about how all the other critics who've been fired should shut the fuck up and all this kind of stuff. It amazes me that all these critics have been fired, and yet Armin White still has a job. Like, that's got to be
a permanent action thing, right? No, I think he has a job because he pisses people off, and people read what stirs them up the most.
Yeah, I mean,
it's in a way, it's brilliant. People will complain about you from one side of their mouth, and then read what you have to say, with the other. But you know, I mean, I do it too. I'm always interested in what he has to say about a movie.
Right. Right.
Yeah, but I don't read it for any thoughtful criticism. I read it for a laugh.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's like watching Jersey Shore. I mean, it's like basically, oh, let's see how drunk Snooki can get and watch her punch some slut out at a bar. Like that.
Yeah.
It's basically the same kind of thing. Like,
that's a great analogy.
I don't think Armand White is putting us on. Dean in the chat room saying that he is. I believe he's at a point now, if he hasn't been all along, that he believes his BS.
Mm-hmm. He believes his own hype, which is always the worst thing. But there's like a British critic I like, David Thompson, and he writes the Biographical Dictionary of Film, and I disagree with him a lot, but he writes it so well, and he's very knowledgeable, and he's not there to get a rise out of you. He believes in what he's saying, and he has the research and the experience to back it up. And let's look at who obviously Armand White is, you know, Pauline Kael is his idol. You know, I didn't agree with her all the time, but she was so eloquent in the way she wrote and everything. You could obviously say, okay, I disagree with you, but you've made an excellent point.
You understood why she believed what she did.
Yeah.
You know, and I guarantee you, Armand White likes a lot of movies and pans a lot of movies that Pauline Kael would completely differ on.
Oh, I think she would have a field. I think she would have a field day. She's probably right there, up there right now. I can't believe this guy worships me. I mean, you know, I think she's really kind of shocked, probably.
She was nuts about some shitty movies too.
Oh yeah, she was,
but she, in her reviews, I think she articulated it well, why she was nuts about them.
Yeah, well, that's true of a lot of people. You know, I, in my opinion, the best writer out there right now for a long time has been Roger Ebert, always has been, and probably the guy who loves movies more than anybody else. And he, without fail, every year goes out on a limb for some movies that straight up fucking suck. Like, without fail, every year, there'll be a couple of them, like Knowing was the one from last year.
Yeah, he really went out for that one.
I mean, he not only writes his review, he goes through his blog and starts blogging about the movie and, like, defending his review and all this kind of stuff. And, I mean, I'll read the review and I'll watch the movie and I'll just think, wow, I got it wrong on that one, Roger. I mean, but I can't argue with him.
But you can't argue
with the
Can I about that? Because I can understand some of these reviews that are like 20 years ago. Do you think Roger Ebert would have written that review? And I'm just wondering if somehow what he's gone through the last 10 years has affected obviously his outlook maybe. So he might think of these things differently.
No doubt. Just look at the way he gushed over Synecdoche, New York. I mean,
yeah,
come on.
That's actually the film I was thinking. not, you know, because that, before Toy Story 3 or Up, that was the movie that was so clearly about death, even though it didn't want to really come out and say it, but the last
right.
hour, it's unavoidable. That's what it
oh,
is.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
There's no doubt. And I think that Roger Ebert would have loved that movie if it would have come out in 1981.
Okay.
But would he have called it the best movie of the year?
Right.
Would he have responded? Would he have, like, really gone out on a limb the way he did for it these days? Absolutely not. No.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone's like that. Like, movies that appeal to me, like, really speak to my own heart, you know? Like, I'll go out on a limb for those movies, too. Like,
right.
So,
I think he's clearly always love movies. You've always gotten a sense that he goes to a movie wanting to love it.
Mm-hmm.
And you
yeah.
get the same sense from someone like Armand White that he goes to a movie to see what barbs he can throw at it. Same thing with Rex
right.
Reed.
With,
yeah,
with Rex
yeah.
Reed? Is that
yeah.
thing? Okay.
Yeah,
yeah,
same thing with him.
He is
actually like 10 times more vicious than Armand White.
Like to see both of them. Get both of them in a room and see what happens.
Anyway, so, all right, other news, Night and Day, I guess that opened today. It's getting mixed notices. Essentially, if you go with its ludicrous, over-the-top premise, you'll like it as a ride, you know?
Isn't that a bullshit review that a lot of stuff is getting these days? Like, aren't we hearing that about every
mm-hmm.
movie that comes out? Like, it's silly, it's dumb, but if you go in just wanting to have a good time, you'll like it. Like, I feel like people say that about every movie that comes out these days.
Let me ask, did they
say that in the 70s? Were they like, Exorcist, it's silly, it's retarded, but if you go in looking for a good time, you'll, you know, like...
Let me ask,
I'm sure they said that about the disaster films of the 70s.
Yeah. Have a good time as the plane crashes into a building.
Yeah.
But it's every week. It's every
yeah, no, that's
week time two now.
It's supposedly A.O. Scott compared it to the recent Ashton Kutcher vehicle.
Yeah, lots of people.
He actually thought Killers was better. Let me
right.
ask this, though. For Tom Cruise, though, to be in something like this, I think is, for him, smart. It would be good to see him in a comedy, like Tropic Thunder. I mean, I don't want to see a whole movie about Levis Grossman, but I do think Tom Cruise is funny, and the idea of him and Cameron Diaz acting together is kind of promising.
Well, there's something interesting
right.
going on. I mean, we are going to see a Les Grossman feature film, apparently.
That's what I mean. I just don't see that. I'd rather see something like this than a whole movie based on a minor character. But
there is something that he is on the upswing,
mm-hmm.
playing kind of maniacal, crazy characters. He's
mm-hmm.
he. It's almost as though he's lampooning his reputation for the last couple of years, and
I think that's good.
Making him popular again.
Yeah, I think that's good though, and I'd be curious to see it.
I think this is him testing the water. Like, he's been talking for years now about doing the Hardy Boys movie,
mm-hmm.
and then this Grossman movie. Like, he's never done an all out comedy like that, really, in a leading role. Like, he did Tropic Thunder, obviously, but he's never been the headliner on a comedy quite like that. I think this is him testing the waters.
Well, Night and Day.
It's somewhere in between.
What about Risky Business? So that would be the last, I guess, all out comedy he.
Oh, come on, that's not a comedy. That movie is definitely very, very serious.
Oh,
like,
it's
you go
serious,
back and
but
watch
you know,
it
but
again.
You know, I know, but I mean, it's like comedy drama. I mean, I would say certain ages, you know, depending on how old you are, it's like you go back and revisit it, you're like, oh, that's funny, you know, but as you get older, it's like, wow,
yeah.
this is much more serious than, because when you go through the college admissions process, especially watching that movie again after that, living through that, it's like, yeah, it's a very serious movie. But, I just thought...
He's done that with Jerry Maguire, too. Jerry Maguire
yeah.
has comedic elements in
yeah.
it, but it's
yeah.
not quite a comedy. You know?
No.
Right.
It's not him,
right.
like, dropping F and C bombs and
no,
flipping
that's
the
true.
Bird to the camera and, like...
But there was something very cathartic about watching him do that in Tropic Thunder.
There was.
I mean, it was really just, I can't describe it, but it was just like, really, there's a catharsis. You could tell that he was having the time.
He was letting loose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was really nice to see.
Well, you know, it was on a dramatic level, it was nice to see that in Magnolia, too.
Yes, absolutely.
We got a call from Nevada. 775 area code, you're on the line.
Hey, it's Day Green. How are you?
Hey,
how
are
you?
Hey.
I'm good. You guys are talking about some of my most favorite topics, so I thought I'd jump in and say hi.
Well, you should jump in. You should have jumped in a long time ago, but I'm glad you jumped in now. Day is the Horror News Net, Radio, and The Gash. So we have a celebrity on the phone with us. And I admitted I had a crush on her the other night on the air. So.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you missed out on that. Yeah, we were on the same time as you, though, so I thought I was playing it safe.
Yeah, well, yeah. I don't know how anybody could possibly have a crush on me through what my mouth on, especially The Gash. I'm surprised I haven't.
You should listen to us some nights. We're pretty foul as it is.
So what were your thoughts on what we were discussing?
Well, there's a few things that you guys touched on, and one of my many jobs, one of my hats, is I'm the managing editor of HorrorNews.net.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm one of the biggest voices when I scream, never listen to reviewers. Never listen to them, because so many people are so different
mm-hmm.
that you're going to get a million different opinions. Some people are going to speak out of their butts.
Right.
I mean, it's just pure and simple. A lot of times they even write dishonest reviews of a film just because they don't like an actress in the film. They don't like the director. I mean, there are so many things that I kind of advocate, you know, find a good reviewer that seems to have the same taste that you do and kind of stick with that person.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else, just ignore them.
I think reviews are actually, I mean, people use reviews as kind of consumer reports now, where should I go see it or not, and they'll read the review to find out for themselves in some cases. I think criticism is a lot more valuable after you've seen the movie.
Yeah.
And to go back and read someone's examination of it, and that's when you can really tell, is this a serious critic or not?
See, I have a peer role. I actually do not review films anymore unless it's something I'm so excited about that
mm-hmm.
I want everyone to know about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generally because, you know, I don't watch trailers. You can tell me, oh, this movie's out, oh, you didn't see the trailer, and I'm going to say no, because if they come on TV, I just change it.
Mm-hmm.
I never read a review before I see a movie, and it's because I want all of the surprises. And if I'm going to see the movie, there's something, maybe I've heard about the story premise. Someone says, "Day, this is what it's about," and I'll say, "Okay, you know." Then I want to check it out.
Right.
I never enjoy reading anybody else's opinion of a film before I watch it, because I think that waters down my experience.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Well, I know the last horror movie to get you know, kind of universally good reviews is the movie we're talking about tonight, The Crazies. it just so happens. Just to let everyone know, those of you that are waiting for that interview, it will air after this roundtable discussion in about a half an hour. I enjoy going back to criticism, and I know everyone here is the same way. For movies, you know, from 20 years ago or something, I read Pauline Kael criticism and other critics just for my leisure enjoyment. Above and beyond anything, people like Roger Ebert and Pauline Kael, they're good writers.
Yeah.
That's very true. I like to kind of go back to their older reviews, things that they've said about films that maybe I've watched a million times, to kind of get the effect from there. I don't like reading reviews of movies that just came out. I also have a very strict policy. Before I review a film, I have to watch it three times. The first time to kind of get the gist, second
mm-hmm.
time to get the experience, the third time so I have a fully encapsulating idea of what's going on.
Right.
And I know a lot of people don't do that. They're just automatically, it's crap. That girl's
right.
boobs were, like, totally not showing right, and then she had, like, a cock nipple. And then, like, this guy was just constantly talking, and I couldn't understand him because he had this thick accent. I think he was Mexican. I mean, you hear that crap all the time. It's like, what is that?
I agree with that, because I've kind of basically stopped writing reviews, because I just don't like the fact, okay, if I go see it on a Friday afternoon, I'm going to write it on a Saturday, and I'd like to see it a couple times. And I'd really, to be very honest with you, the best way to really gauge the impact of the film is to watch it, I guess now it's 8 months that it comes on cable now, after it comes out, that window's getting shorter and shorter, to watch it again, you know, months later to see if you feel the same way about it. Because even if you love a film, chances are you'll watch it again, you'll be like a couple months or even a couple years later, well, you'll see some things that maybe you missed the first time. Regardless, one way or the other, you're going to pick up on some stuff you didn't catch the first time.
In repeated viewings, you really start to see the mechanics of
yeah.
the filmmaking. You know, the magic spell is kind of broken in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's arguments for and against. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Paul and Kael never watched anything twice. And there's something powerful and telling about being fresh off of that first experience of seeing a movie and expressing those thoughts.
Well, that's the beauty of note-taking.
Except you're not, that's true.
Yeah. You sit down after, and that's what I always do. The very first time I watch a film, I sit down and I write down, this is what my first thoughts are. Then the second time I watch it, I'll write down a few more notes, and by the third time I watch it, I know that I have a full, I think I can have a pretty good, perfectly good grasp of what I've just seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think it's important for, you know, somebody who's serious about reviewing a film to do that. But another thing I wanted to touch on that you guys said, and it made me laugh, was that a lot of reviews are saying if you just want to have, like, a good mindless fun time and just for a good ride, and how everything's saying that nowadays, that's thanks to your economy. Right now the economy is so bad that a lot of people aren't wanting to invest money. They're not wanting to take a risk. So they're going to do something just mindless. They know they can pop out real quick. They don't want to over-depress their audiences. You're going to see, and we've already seen a kind of an upward scale of horror films due to the fact that those, you know, whenever you're in a bad economy, you get a lot of horror films.
Yeah.
Because they kind of feel that, you know, dramas, people are already crying enough. Comedies, not everybody wants to laugh, but nobody minds getting scared.
We're talking about that with some filmmakers we talked to last week, and talking about trends in horror, and he said, you know, is it any coincidence that torture porn came to be in the Bush administration?
That's true. That's very true.
Let
me ask you this, Dave, since we have you on the line, and I wanted to ask you and a lot of other people this. We had, like, a good horror sci-fi movie come out, and it actually got very good reviews for the most part, and died at the box office, Splice. What happens in a situation where we do have something, I mean, maybe not everyone liked it, but it got more, let me say, more positive reviews than negative.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah. Well, normally things like that, and this is why, there wasn't really huge names in that film. There wasn't huge names, there wasn't a hugely known director. Most people who knew anybody in that film that had anything to do with that film are genre fans.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time, your audience is not going to take a big risk. If they don't see Angelina, they don't see Brad, they don't see Tom, they don't see any of these people, then they don't think that it's worth anything. I actually, my stepdad is what the number one big offender. He kind of believes that, like, if it doesn't have this amazing name in it, that the movie's going to suck. This is what I call the ignorance of the audience. So what's pretty much going to happen is this is going to be a word-of-mouther.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to come out on DVD. You know, somebody's going to get it. They're going to sit down. They're going to show their friends. It's going to be bored. It's going to be probably in the $5 bin within 2 years at Walmart. But unfortunately, that kind of happens whenever you don't have hugely known names in a film and you're going to a major
in
audience
the
market.
In the horror genre, I mean, huge names are kind of moot. I mean, you rarely get huge names in the horror genre. I think what they're depending on now to get butts in seats is nostalgia and title recognition. That's why you see all the remakes.
Yeah.
A lot of remakes for horror films.
Now, remakes are an easy dollar. That's in your automatic audience. That actually, that whole little trend is coming from people downloading illegal, like, movies illegally on the internet.
Right.
The movie studios are losing so much money because of that. Now that they're broke, pretty much, they're kind of targeting the disposable incomes of teens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So your PG-13s, your remakes, all of these things are coming from the studios being smart and saying, hey, you know what? Their dad used to watch this, their mom used to watch this, so we're going to make this now. We're going to make it to where, you know, Joey at McDonald's can get off his shift, pick up his girlfriend, and take her to a movie.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
So everyone who's downloading movies illegally, you can thank yourself for the remakes and the PG-13 movies. Woohoo!
Yeah. The remakes are nothing new, though, but it's just become
more. No, they're
more,
nothing
more
new,
prevalent.
But they're
they're
hyped
remaking
right
Ben-Hur already. When that, you know, they're remaking all, you know, just those kind of films already when we had talkies and everything after the silent era. But it does seem, that's right, about the downloading and everything, but we are getting an enormous amount of remakes. But it's also to sell that DVD box set, too, and the DVDs of the older films. I mean,
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, the only good thing that comes out of remakes is that within 2 to 3 months of them coming into theaters, you can actually buy the original movie really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
That's
true.
The only good thing. They'll release it on DVD and sell it for dirt cheap and then release the remake into the theaters just a few months later. That's the only really good thing that's coming out of them. But it's an automatic audience. They know that this movie is going to put the butts in the seats because the kids want to see it, the parents want to see what they've done with it. We complain about them, but we still go and see them because we want to see what they did too.
Mm-hmm.
It's an automatic audience, and they're guaranteed to make money.
Well, it's odd because the Breck Eisner, who's on tonight, The Crazies is obviously a remake. I think it's an exceptional remake of a film that, you know, unless you're a diehard genre fan, you've probably forgotten about. But he also has three more remakes in the works, The Brood, Escape from New York, and Flash Gordon. So
now, I do have to say, when I heard I made a joke the other day saying that I wanted to remake The Brood.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a joke because I was making, you know, just fun of how I had my children's advice that I popped them out of my side.
That's the Oliver Reed one, right? The Brood.
Yeah. I cannot say that I am disappointed about The Brood being remade, only because, yes, it was a fantastic movie. Yes, it's a classic, but now we can do so much more with it. I just hope to God they keep the CGI down to a minimum and
mm-hmm.
really go back old school horror, bring in the effects,
but
bring in the...
There will be no one... The only problem the remake will have is there will be no one like Oliver Reed who can stay up drinking heavily till you got to get to the set and perform flawlessly throughout the movie. This is a guy who just drank all day, all night, but when he had to be on the set, boom, he was as professional as they come.
Well, he's amazing in everything he does. Even when he was in Baron Munchausen, do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He's just always amazing.
Yeah, no, it was this great book I read earlier this year, Hellraisers, about him and Peter O'Toole, Richard Harris, and Richard Burton, and just how they could party. And then to some of them, they paid dearly, but he could function. It was, people were just amazed how, hey, weren't you just drinking like everyone under the table last night? And
you know who that author said he thinks was the most talented of all of those?
Who's that?
Who?
Peter O'Toole.
Nice.
He thinks Peter O'Toole is the greatest talent of all of that group that he wrote about. I thought that was interesting.
That is. That's very interesting.
All right. Thank you so much for calling in. Call back anytime you'd like.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
I've enjoyed it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Chris, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. By the way, Breck talks about the Brood remake, and if it happens, it's not going to happen with him.
Right.
He talks about that during the interview. The Expendables got its rating today, and it is rated R.
I can't wait. I don't understand the two movies besides Inception come out the same day, Scott Pilgrim and The Expendables. I mean, this is not like a great, you know, like heavy summer, but those are the two after Inception I'm really looking forward to. So.
Yeah, yeah. I saw a couple of good documentaries. You know, HBO has their season,
mm-hmm.
and you know they're one of the major buyers at Sundance every year because they buy up the documentaries for their series, their season. And it is documentary season now. So I saw the Smashes Camera documentary and the Gasland documentary.
Oh, how was Gasland?
It was very good. It's a little scary. I mean, the natural gas companies that buy these properties.
Mm-hmm.
Well, underneath is a, you know, an ocean of natural gas, and you know, the owners sell out essentially, and they pay the consequences. I mean, diseases, sickness, the natural gases and methane in their water. I mean, they turn on the water in their faucet and set it on fire. I mean, that's how toxic their water becomes, and you know, it speaks to what's going on today. And Smash's Camera was great. It's about one of the all-time most heralded and hated paparazzi.
Right.
who essentially stalked Jackie O for, you know, 40 years. It was a big love affair.
Mm.
It's very interesting.
No, I want to see that. I saw the Joan Rivers documentary.
I liked it.
Yeah, I really liked it. I... telling people, like, when I was leaving, you know, because we had interviewed her, I said, you really get, you know, that's what she's like, but it's a very honest portrayal of her. At times,
too
honest. I mean.
Yeah. Chris, what do you think of this news, that Craig Brewster, the director of Hustle and Flow, is now directing, Craig Brewer, I'm sorry, is now directing Footloose?
Well, he's always, or so far anyway, has done musically themed films, so it sort of fits into that. And, you know, I liked his first two movies. I liked him a lot. I loved Hustle and Flow, and I sort of was confused about Black Snake Moan for a few days and then decided that I fucking loved it.
Yeah,
and that's sort of what happened. The movie was like a grenade. It went off a little while after I saw it, and then I couldn't stop thinking about it, and then I proceeded to watch it, I think, three more times after that. So I'm down, you know. I mean, this is just one of those situations where somebody hops onto it. You know, if when you had told me that they were remaking Lolita back in 1999 or whatever it was, I would have been like, you probably shouldn't make a remake of Stanley Kubrick movie. If you told me it was Adrian Lyne, I would have been like, man, I love Adrian Lyne. Why is he doing that? If I would have stopped and thought for a minute, I would have realized, wow, Adrian Lyne's awesome. He probably knows what he's doing. So that's sort of the stance I'm going to take with Craig Brewer here, which is, you know, he's proved himself to be an interesting director who doesn't make soft movies so far. He's picking up this Footloose thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hope he does something interesting with it. Now, having said that, he might go and do the thing that, what's his name, from Your Friends and Neighbors and In the Company of Men has gone and done, which is to go
don't say that.
Well, you know what I mean. Like, it
yes,
does
I do.
Feel like, I'm sorry, his name is totally a
Neil LaBute.
Neil LaBute. Like, I really hope that that's not what Craig Brewer goes and does, but I never would have thought that Neil LaBute would have been capable of making a completely commercial jump like that. I don't know. I don't like Footloose that much. I don't really give a shit about it. It's not a movie that I'm precious about or anything. So I don't give a fuck about them remaking it. I don't care. You know, like...
I think it's ripe for a remake. I mean, you know...
I don't know how they're going to make it edgy. I mean, how do you
Who's
make Footloose
Who's
going to
play the John Lithgow part? That's what I want to know.
The John Lithgow part. I don't know. They should use the voice in Ned Beatty.
I saw The Killer Inside Me.
I didn't get to see that. I pulled it up on demand, and it kept stopping as soon as he started spanking Jessica Alba. And I was like, come on, man.
So I watched it, and I will say this. She what part of the film did she walk out of? Do we know?
No.
Okay. Well, she was present for the filming of it, right? I mean, that's not a doppelganger. She was – no, I just know. Because we're watching that, I could tell everyone, you know, she walked out of this. And my brother was just like – well, she was there filming it, right? I mean, what was there to be, you know, and she is...
She has since defended it.
Okay, all right. I did not know that. But it's, you know, it's... I like that they kept it in the period that it was written and that the that it takes place in. So I thought that was... Because I thought they were going to modernize it, but they didn't. It's interesting. I don't think it's as controversial as they want it to be. It's okay. I got to be honest. It's really, for me at least, and I like Michael Winterbottom a lot. His next film, I promise you, will be controversial, but it's not this one.
What's his next
Michael, one? Chris, say what you were going to say.
Michael Winterbottom, for me, has always been this guy who's made a lot of movies that were really close to being awesome, but not quite. Like,
yeah.
None of his movies really go to that 4-star mark for me. Like, they come close. You know, they're interesting.
Is 4-star, like
right, definitely. But and his movies are interesting. I don't dislike any of his movies that I've ever seen. But they never really come. You know, he's a little bit overhyped as far as I'm concerned.
Well, his next movie, I don't know the title of it, but it's about Palestine in the 30s, told from the point of view of the British anti-terrorist squads, and it paints basically the Stern Gang as terrorists, and you know, they referred to the how do I want to put this in the right context, is what would be the future Israelis, the settlers, the Jewish settlers who came from Europe and everything, were the Stern gang. They're going to paint. He wants to paint them in like as a terrorist. Like I guess making the parallel to today, what's going on in that part of the world today, and where as the British are trying to really like caught in the middle of this, and it's he says you know they say that you know this is going to be very controversial. What you want to do? And he goes, I hope so.
Caught in the middle yeah. or somewhat responsible.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the British, you know, I don't want to get into this on this show. This is not, but I'll just say that this, if this movie does see the, when it does come out, there will be a lot of angry people on both sides.
Wow, I Ben, the British don't need any people angry at them right now. I'll
yeah,
tell you
exactly.
What.
You know, speaking of the British,
uh-oh.
I saw this HBO thing, The Special Relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is about the relationship between Clinton and Tony Blair. And, you know, yet another time that Michael Sheen plays Tony Blair. I think he's pretty much mastered it.
He's got an outfit.
The big story was Dennis Quaid in this movie. I wasn't necessarily taken by Dennis Quaid. I was paying attention to his makeup more than I was him.
I finally, while watching this, realized what everyone didn't like about W., so much, and it is you are watching, feel like you're just watching a docudrama essentially, and it's so recent and everything. I just do feel like I'm watching like CNN clips almost. I mean,
right.
I hate to say that. It's a very good. The guy who directs it is actually a good director and everything. I actually thought Hope Davis was good as
right.
Hillary Clinton, but it almost feels like it has a wax museum quality to it. Almost.
Well, certainly Dennis Quaid in that makeup.
Yeah, I was waiting for that, but yes. But
it's fine. The movie's fine. I tell you what, I saw a far superior Michael Sheen movie the other night that has gone completely under the radar.
I think I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, it's called Unthinkable. And Michael Sheen plays really against type as a terrorist. But Samuel Jackson, Carrie Ann Moss, Michael Sheen are the three leads in it. It's basically about terrorism and torture.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very intense
movie.
Where can we
see this? Where can we rent this?
Redbox. Yeah, get
Red
it at Redbox.
Redbox. All right, Redbox. Cool. All right. I thought you meant the other one, the Damned United.
No.
Okay.
This one is something else. This is a hot button movie, and I'm surprised that it got buried. Because it's basically one of the most thoughtful, visceral movies about these topics that I've seen come out lately.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool. We'll definitely look for that, yeah.
Check it out. And then I saw Shutter Island again.
And you liked it more the second time.
No, I didn't like it more. I just paid attention to different things.
Mm, okay.
You know.
I misinterpreted your Facebook update then, I'm sorry.
It's kind of a more enriching experience, I said, but meaning that I there was more to feed on, kind of. I was paying attention to little details and stuff
mm-hmm.
that on a second viewing. So anyone that's seen it once knows what I mean. I still don't know where it falls in Scorsese's resume.
Oh, come on. You know it falls in, with the lesser movies. I mean, I like some of the filmmaking in that movie as much as the next guy, but it just does not belong with the... I mean, let's say that Scorsese has three classes of movies. He has the Taxi Drivers and the Casinos and the Goodfellas and the King of Comedies. Then he has the other movies that are somewhere in the middle, the things that are definitely good, but certainly not his best stuff, you know, like maybe After Hours and maybe some of the documentaries and that sort of thing. And then he's got another class, which is movies that are watchable, but definitely don't feel like a Scorsese movie. Definitely don't feel, you know, like Bringing Out the Dead and Kundun and things like that. It belongs in that class. It belongs in the C class. He doesn't
that's
make bad
you,
movies.
That's
he doesn't
where you
make
think
movies
it belongs.
Just, oh, absolutely. He
I think it belongs in the middle.
Suck. You think so?
I think so. What do you think his worst movie is?
His worst movie? That's what I was just about to say. He doesn't make movies that suck. Like when you ask that question, there's nothing that really jumps to mind. Nothing springs to my mind. You know, there's movies that he's made that are lesser, like Bringing Out the Dead is the first one that jumps to mind. It just doesn't work. You know, obviously New York, New York would be in that
yeah.
C-class category, too.
You know, maybe even Gangs of New York, actually, is a movie that does not work. It's just overbloated and just there's too much. It definitely needed another editing job, and it was sort of underthunk in the screenplay department. I think it belongs in that C class. I just don't think there's much to go back to on it. It's one of those that maybe in 10 years you'll see on cable and you watch it, but don't, you know, it's not a DVD I'm going to be picking up. It's not a Blu-ray I'm dying to see.
I think
that's saying a lot.
I think Bringing Out the Dead it should be quintessential Scorsese. It is. It's just not one that I enjoy revisiting.
Yeah. I would put it in the middle, but more so to me it's just a character study about DiCaprio's character, really. That's the thing that comes through the loudest for me. Not
right.
All the little tricks and everything, the plot points. It's just watching DiCaprio. There's something I like, especially the last scene. I'm particularly taken with, you say, the last 10 minutes between him and Ruffalo. I like a lot. I know what Chris is saying. It's hard to pinpoint. Like, he's never really made a truly bad movie. Not something that you're going to say, oh, this sucks shit. You're never going to say that about him. Not yet, at least, unless there's something.
I actually think his virtuosity kind of works against Shutter Island. It was crystallized when we were talking to Chris upon the release of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think all that style detracts from the profoundness of the themes that movie deals with. You're appreciating the style of the film more than you are content, in a way.
I also think the film suffers only because of the film that comes out the following week that's sort of like the same kind of thing, at least environmentally, and that's The Ghost Rider.
Right.
There's similarities. Well,
which is a far superior movie. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. And, you know, Kundun is not... I don't watch that and think that's a Scorsese movie.
No, I don't. I think as someone brought up in the chat room, it's like the Soderbergh experimental film. Movie Buff, I think, brought that up.
But reading it on paper, I wouldn't see Age of Innocence as a Scorsese movie. But when you watch it, yeah, it is. You know, you feel it's being true to who he is. I think that's one of the upper class Scorsese movies.
Oh yeah, I like that one a lot. And I also, that's another one. Daniel Day-Lewis, just a fantastic performance from him. As New Yorker.
All right, let's see what other news is here before we get to our interview for the night. We all interested in seeing Cyrus?
Yeah, I am.
I just love the poster for Cyrus. Like, I think the poster is so fucking hilarious. Like, with Marissa Tomei sitting on the couch with Jonah Hill with that look on his face as he's looking to what's his name? That's the funniest poster.
Riley.
Yeah, John C. Reilly. That's the funniest poster since the 40-Year-Old Virgin poster, in my opinion. Like, that's really, really an underrated poster.
Yeah.
The movie itself, no, I'm not that interested in saying
it. I just think I would have said that before, but I read a Rolling Stone interview with Jonah Hill that kind of changed my perception of him. I'm not saying that will affect, you know, the movie or anything, but it was just interesting. He's got quite a mouth on him in some regards, but that you would expect. But I am curious about the movie because I like when John C. Reilly loses it. On screen, it is something to behold. It looks like he loses it with Jonah Hill in this one.
Right. Documentary-wise, I really want to see the Pat Tillman story. That's the next documentary I'm looking forward to. Film, you know, trailer-wise, there's been a lot of trailers that came out recently. Mm-hmm. You guys all see the trailer to The Green Hornet?
I haven't watched it yet. I did not watch it yet.
What do you think, Chris?
I was surprised, I guess. I wasn't envisioning them doing the whole Seth Rogen character, like, with the movie. To keep in mind, I don't know anything about The Green Hornet. I don't even know if that was a movie or a TV show, to be perfectly honest with you. Like, I don't even know. I know that Bruce Lee played Kato, and then there's a Green Hornet character that's Caucasian, and that's about all I know. I'm not that interested, I gotta be honest. Like, I just am so over the comic book and superhero-type movies. The only thing that is interesting to me about this movie is the fact that it's directed by Michel Gondry. I'm not interested in absolutely anything else. And this is what I wanted to say when we were talking earlier with the chick whose name escapes me.
Oh, Day Green. Day Green.
Yeah, that chick, yeah. I do think there are movies you want to see. Like, there are movies you want to see, like Inception. I'm going to see that. I don't give a fuck what Roger Ebert or Owen Gleiberman or Michael Phillips or A.O. Scott or any of these guys or Peter Travers. I don't care what any of them say. They could all say it's a turd. I'm going to see it, period. End of discussion. And then there's movies that I'm absolutely not going to see. I don't care what any of those guys say about it, like Sex and the City 2. Definitely not going to see it. It doesn't matter.
The thing where
I think reading reviews before you see a movie comes in handy is the movies that are in the middle there. The movies that you're kind of like, maybe I'll go see it, maybe not. Movies like Cyrus or other movies like that you're just not like, absolutely I want to see it or absolutely I don't want to see it. Like, this is where it comes in handy, you know. What does so-and-so think about it? What does this person think about it? That's how Green Hornet will be for me. Like, if everybody says it's good, I'll definitely go see it. Like, if everybody says it's bad, I definitely won't. If a couple of them say it's good and a couple of them say it's bad, I'm on the fence. Like, that's where I think that the reviews come in handy. I don't think it's a good idea to ever say, don't read reviews ever. Like, I don't think that's good. I don't think that's a wise decision at all.
But do you appreciate the notion of truly being able to find valuable criticism when you read?
I absolutely do. Oh, you know, yeah. I do. I mean, and the thing is, like, I also don't think that it's true that you should just find one reviewer that you like and read that person and disregard everyone else. I have about 6 or 7 reviewers that I've read for years. I know them. I trust them. I trust that they're being honest when they write. And Armand White is not one of them, by the way. I literally trust these guys, and I read the reviews because I know that if I read all these guys' reviews, they might not all say that a movie's good. They might not all say that a movie's bad. They might be mixed. You know, some say it's good, some say it's bad. But between all those guys and all their personalities and all their writing styles, I can sort of triangulate whether or not this is going to be the kind of movie that I maybe should give a chance or not.
Right.
You know what I
right.
mean?
Well,
that's how I roll. And I also do what you do, which is to watch a movie and then go back and read the reviews, because it's a good way to sort of digest what you've just seen with the help of Roger Ebert. And who better to help you digest than a guy who can't swallow?
Yeah, I mean, but, like, there's some reviewers, like Vincent Canby, you know,
so
loved Woody Allen, never gave him very rarely gave him a bad review. Kale adored Brando. So there's some, like, reviewers like that, when you know who they like and everything, I think it's always very interesting to read their reviews of people that they admire greatly, and you know they admire greatly. And,
yeah, it's hard to avoid that. I mean, we all have that.
Yeah.
Another trailer, the Harrison Ford movie, I forget what that's called. It's The Newsroom. It's his version of Switching Channels.
Morning Glory.
The Front Page. Okay, it's the third or fourth remake of The Front Page. Okay.
Yeah, Morning Glory Hole. What do we think of that?
I think it looks very, very funny. I gotta be honest.
I think it looks entertaining too. Yeah.
I think it could be a lot of fun. You know, we forget that there's movies like, yeah, okay, Broadcast News. They sort of already did it. You know, but you know, I mean, it's been a while. It's got a good cast. Harrison Ford is funny, you know.
Yeah, and he's Working Girl. He's great in Working Girl. I don't care what anyone says. He's wonderful in that film. So,
It looks very funny.
Yeah.
And Conviction. Have you seen this trailer to Conviction?
What's Conviction? I'm really
Conviction out. Is Sam Rockwell plays Hilary Swank's brother, who goes to prison for something he claims a crime he didn't commit. Hilary Swank goes to law school, becomes like a lawyer to defend him or something. An inspiring triumph of the human spirit, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It looks to me like one of these movies that is bucking for Oscar, like in All the King's Men or something, and it ain't going to make it. Because
look what happened to that. Wow. No, but that is a good cast, and I'll watch Rockwell on anything, I mean, at this point, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to predict what's going to be in All the King's Men, because, you know, every year there's a movie that All the King's Men was just like that. Like, All the King's Men was, no one could have told you 2 months before All the King's Men came out, like, no one could have told
right.
you, that movie's going to suck. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to be 100%, it's going to be roundly rejected by every reputable reviewer, and it will not get a single Academy Award. On the contrary, it will be considered one of the worst movies of the year. If somebody would have told you that 2 months before All the King's Men was released, you would have literally called them a fucking asshole and smacked them in the face.
Like, right, yeah, yeah. I mean, it is amazing.
There's always going to be a movie like that, and you can't tell which ones are and which ones are not going to be from the preview. Having said that about previews, there's a new preview for Inception out, and I don't want to see it.
Right.
I've seen enough about this movie already.
Yeah.
I mean, it's enough already. We're getting too many previews about these movies, you know?
Yeah,
like,
I think you're right. It is gotten to the point, especially in Inception, where, all right, we know the basic gist and idea of what the story is. Cut it out. Let's just see. If you're going to do this, then release the movie tomorrow or something. Because what's going to happen is what happens with all these movies. Everyone's going to go see it, and people are going to start blabbering about it. And it does take the fun out. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It does. And it's hard to. I mean, yeah, I will do all right online. I won't go, but it doesn't matter how hard you try to block stuff out. It always manages to seep through some ways. And for a film like this that we were talking about just a couple months ago, we had no idea what it really was. And now once that first trailer comes out, and it's
I was thinking about this earlier today when I was reading a review. Joe Blow, they had a screening of the new Meet the Little Fokker movie. Two days ago or whatever, in New Jersey. Oh, the movie's done. It's completed.
Okay.
It was screened for some theater in New Jersey like 2 days ago, and Joe Blow had a review of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, we're about to be completely douched with trailers for this movie. Like, this movie comes out in a couple months. We're just about to get a fucking money shot across the face of Meet the Fokker previews for the next 6 months or whatever it is till this movie comes out. We're going to be bombarded. And whatever two or three or four really big laugh-out-loud moments there are in this movie, and there will be a couple, we're going to know what they are before we see it, whether it's a foreskin being dropped into fondue or whatever it is, you know, like whatever the moment is, we're going to see it. I was thinking how exciting and how awesome it must have been for someone to have seen this movie with nothing. Can you imagine what that would be like? I mean, maybe it's a bad example because not everybody likes those movies, but to see a
No, it's as good as
comedy.
Any other example. And you understand why they give so much away. It's a studio decision to protect their investment.
Financially, I do.
I have to say, I like
That's why you got to go to the art houses to be surprised anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right. But there are a couple of trailers that, like, for movies that I absolutely love and adore, where I thought the trailer sucked. But the reason, and like, not sucked, but they were, like, very run-of-the-mill, like the trailer for Inglourious Basterds. I like it, but it didn't blow me away, but they gave away nothing. There was nothing in those two trailers that they showed that gave me any hint of really what the film would be, the final product. I like the trailer for The Social Network, this teaser trailer they have. That's good, because it's just a voiceover, and just a lot of words and everything, but I like that. The trailer for The American that I saw today is doesn't give that much away. So,
right.
But I agree with it. With something like Inception, though, you're just giving away too much at this point.
Hey, The American, by the way, do we need another Sniper with a Heart of Gold movie? Isn't that basically what this is? Like, doesn't this seem like something we've seen 6 or 7 times in the last 5 years based on what just the general stuff I know about it already? Am I crazy? Like,
It could be because it's Clooney. I'm willing to give it more of a benefit of the doubt. But I know exactly what you're saying. It does feel like we have seen this story many times, not just recently, but throughout, I would say for the last 50, 60 years almost.
It's funny how they make so many movies about hitmen. I mean, who really shares a profession? Shares an empathy with that kind of character. I think, you know, Assassination Tango was one thing, though. I mean, that
well,
wasn't
just
strictly
that
about
the
it.
Val's coming on the show. That's
I don't know. I haven't heard anything.
Okay.
But I mean, that's so much more than a hitman movie.
I'm not saying they can't make a good hitman movie. But like the movie, I don't know. I feel like George Clooney's getting into a weird territory. You notice how every movie he makes, he's sort of a loner. Like he's this guy who like operates by his own rules and like has his own life and nobody can get in there. Like you never see George Clooney in a movie where he's like a family man. And, like, he's got a lot of love in his life. He's always, like, very solitary, like, Up in the Air and Ocean's 11
Actually,
and the New American movie. And I just feel like, I mean, it's always a shot of him, like, in a airport with not a lot of people around, and he's carrying some luggage, whether it's got, like, you know, whether it's got business materials or a gun or whatever is in that luggage, like, and he's got this very serious look on his face, like someone just farted in front of him on the People Mover. Like, we, like, I feel like we've, this is up in the air meets out of sight or something like that. Like, we've totally
seen the
movie.
Let me ask you this. Do you, he's gotten to that point, though, where he's in these movies that are very critically acclaimed. One of these is one of the things he's really, but now he's really trying to gun for stuff that's going to, you know, blockbuster, or at least something that's going to make him bankable. Because while we know who he is and we like his work, he's got the critical aspects down. He's not a moneymaker.
No, he's not. And this movie does not seem like the kind of movie that's going to be the moneymaker.
Yeah.
Like, this does not seem like the Bourne Identity. This
no,
is
not
that kind of sniper movie. You know?
Unless Anton Corbin, who I like as a director a lot, I only know Control, and he's more of a photographer. He's actually claimed a famous photography. I don't know, you know, like I said, it's hard to tell from the trailer, but I don't know if this is going to be like this might be one of those action movies that doesn't catch on. It might not be the traditional action movie, and in that sense, what we were talking about with the movie going public earlier, the mass movie, it's going to fall flat, you know.
I think so, too. It's going to be another The International or,
right.
You know, another The Green Zone. It's going to be one of these movies that people just feel like they can't get in touch with because there's nothing, I don't know, like maybe I'm giving like just a too much of a quick capsule review of a movie that I haven't seen yet, but I just don't connect with that trailer at all, like not like zero. Like
you just feel like you've seen it though.
It's very sterile to me. Yeah. Like doesn't feel like something I want to see at all.
Right. No, that's understandable.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting about the Men Who Stare at Goats. So someone brought that up in the chat room. I keep forgetting about these films that he made last year. So.
Yeah. Well, that's what everyone else did. They forgot about.
Yeah, him. I know, and it's like that. I don't know. Yeah, that's we won't go there.
You're right, though. There is this notion that George Clooney is a major movie star, but outside of Ocean's movies that had the backing of six other big movie stars, there's been no real evidence of that.
No, absolutely not. And to the contrary, like these movies, a lot of these movies that he makes are fairly big budget movies. I mean, some of them are not. Up in the Air is not a big budget movie, but some of these other movies, like The American, I guarantee you, is a fairly large budget.
Yeah, I would
movie.
Think so. Just the location and just the if you're just looking at some of the scenes, sequences, and everything from the trailer, yeah.
Right. Or his paycheck alone. Like, I mean, this guy makes $20 million a movie, you know? I mean, nobody goes to see these movies.
Yeah,
and that's sort of a testament to him. Like, that's not a knock on him necessarily.
No.
He makes interesting movies.
He does.
But it is a good question, like, when are the two things going to sort of meld again? But the thing is, his career has always been that way. Other than the Ocean's 11 movies, from the start, even when he's done ER, you know, he made these movies like The Peacemaker. That wasn't a success.
No,
he made Out of Sight, which was a great movie, but it was not a success. You know, like, his movies are, from the beginning, not successful.
The first movie, I think, where everyone became aware, like, he is all this, but just sadly the public didn't embrace it. But it is, I mean, I think he's terrific in that film, and I think it's a very good movie, but you're right. It was at the time when that came out, it was also considered, I think it was just 98, right? The summer of 98?
Right.
And it was considered the first grown-up movie. The first grown-up movie of the summer. But, you know, it didn't catch
It was a total bomb.
Well,
yeah. From Dusk Till Dawn was the same way. Like, I think that was his first movie after ER, and it's a very good movie, and it's caught on. It's sort of a cult classic now, but it was not successful either. Like, you literally cannot point to anything other than the Ocean's movies. I don't think. I mean, nothing springs to mind.
Nothing that reached blockbuster status.
There are great. There are great films there, but as far as blockbusters, you're right. Outside the Ocean's movies, those are the money makers.
Anyone else like that? Is Brad Pitt like that? I don't know. Can any star, I guess this is the more general question than my point, can any star open a movie anymore?
The stars that we think of when we think of the A-list movie stars? Because, I mean, obviously there's lots of guys that open movies, like,
can we depend on a star to open a movie anymore?
Yeah. I think there are stars that you can depend on to open a movie. There are some you can point to. Adam Sandler, for instance. Like Grown Ups comes out this weekend. That movie's going to make money. His movies always make money. Like, they're always popular. There have been one or two that were not as successful as the others. But for the most part, when you look at his movies throughout the years, his movies make money. Like, they
When he does his juvenile comedy thing,
That's what does well. That's what we're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. Yeah, unfortunately, the few in between there, The Rain on Me and The Punch Drunk Loves especially, the interesting movies, those are the ones that do not make any money.
No, that's
just
a bad thing. It's like with Jim Carrey. When Jim Carrey does something like Eternal Sunshine, it's when these guys really show us, hey, this goes with also Man on the Moon, too. It's just people don't embrace it. It's sad people don't embrace it. But there's another Clooney movie, which is a great film, and I think we all three of us love it. Someone brought up it, is Three Kings. But that didn't do great either, from what I remember.
No, it did not. That's another one that did not perform well. It's an interesting question, Jamie. I don't know that anyone really jumps to mind. Right now, there are no stars that leap to my mind anyway. I mean, Brad Pitt has had successful movies throughout the years, like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, as few as 5 years ago, was a popular movie. It was very successful. It was very widely. But you wonder how much of that had to do with the movie and how much of that had to do with him, as opposed to that was the movie where he and Angelina Jolie met and, of course, broke up. Jennifer Aniston, and that was all in the tabloids and whatnot. When you think of all the major movie stars, that's an interesting question. I don't know that there is a lot of them that are just so dependable. Like, I think everybody is pretty much a risk these days in this.
What about Will Smith?
Climate.
Someone brought
Will
him up in the chat room.
I guess Will Smith falls in that same category as Adam Sandler. Yeah, there have been a couple that didn't quite work as well as everyone expected, but for the most part, even he can go and make something like Hancock, or he can do The Men in Black and stuff like that. There's a few, like Wild Wild West, that were not as popular as the others, but he can even go and make something like The Pursuit of Happiness, which doesn't open huge, but it has these legs, and it ends up making over $100 million, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so I think maybe he falls into that category.
Yeah. I think 7 Pounds, I think, is the only one that didn't really, recent ones that didn't catch on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Too.
I was busy doing something else.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jamie. For leaving.
What were you saying?
No, we were talking about the question you posed.
Yeah, really.
I know. Hey, I'm the host. It's just my job to throw things out there and let you guys.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, I don't know that no star is foolproof anymore, and I think our star system is faltering, and I think that's been expressed in the past couple of years.
I think that's very true, and I think the names that you guys brought up are probably do represent as far as that. I mean, look at Harrison Ford. He hasn't really, outside of the Indiana Jones, and that's an awful movie, but he hasn't really been in anything that's really...
Another prime example.
Yeah.
And the example of the guy that came out with the movie today, Tom Cruise.
Yeah, that's the one that leads to mind.
I'd be curious to see how this does, though, because next week, I guess everything gets slaughtered because of the Twilight movie.
Absolutely.
And The Last Airbender. If that might be another one that the kids are excited about.
Are you kidding?
They want to see it.
I know they want to see it. I think it will be a successful movie, but I don't think it'll be anywhere in the league as the Eclipse movie.
Oh, God,
no
I don't think anything. There's no. But, I mean, this thing does. When they showed that teaser trailer last summer, people were going ape shit, and I was just like, I must be missing something. I have no idea what this is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a movie. It's not a movie made for us. I mean,
No. It's made for that generation that grew up on that show, I guess, or whatever.
But Shyamalanga Ding Ding, actually, he's already written his next movie and cast people.
Yeah. He can still get names. He can still get these names, these huge names. Bruce Willis has a relationship with him, but guys like Bradley Cooper's fucking hot right now. A-team aside, like, everyone follows up their big successful movie with a movie that's not as successful. Okay,
you know what? You know what? I think the reason why he signed a movie so quickly, why he pushed to have it signed so quickly before Airbender comes around, is in case Airbender tanks and he becomes unemployable for a time.
Oh, I don't think Airbender will tank. Like,
I don't think it'll tank.
I don't know that it'll tank either, but I guarantee it's kind of safeguard.
You think he's gun-shy. He's gun-shy.
Yeah. I mean, his last two movies have been I mean, they're not just, it's not just that they didn't do well. They're kind of notorious.
Yeah, his last three movies didn't do well, but his last two movies were, like, really, really bad. I mean, like, The Lady in the Water and The Happening are sort of epic in their badness.
I don't know, it's like, it almost seems like for The Happening, he didn't even show up. It's like, you guys just do what you want, I'm going to go in the trailer. It seemed like at times.
Yeah. I would have enjoyed a What's Happening film from
that
him.
That would have been better.
a lot more. I guess it'll make a lot of money. And plus, I sense, like, fatigue that's setting in at the box office, because a lot of these movies this summer haven't performed as well as one had hoped. It's down something like 20-30% since last summer. I mean, a big drop from last summer, when you were populated with like eight different sequels during last summer. That's really what drove last summer.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the worst summer, and I don't like summer movies that much, but it's been the worst summer in a long time. Not only, I mean, I never liked the movies of summer, but now the movies aren't making money either. Like, that's what's interesting. Like, these movies aren't making money. Like, I always hate the movies, but now we're getting movies like Prince of Persia and Sex and the City 2 that are just sort of floundering.
The worst Memorial Day released, don't forget financially, but just the worst titles released in Memorial Day history that I can remember. The most unappealing thing, that there would be no reason to go to the movies. Those movies, just there's no interest. You know, there's just like, this is the best you can do for one of the biggest weekends of the summer. This is what,
and it's so weird what does catch on and what does stick. Like, Shrek is number one for three weekends in a row in spite of all the other movies that come out.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that knocks it off of the top spot is The Karate Kid in spite of The A-Team. Like, why did that one catch on?
Right.
Is it because it was a family movie? I mean, like, really, like, family movies have been the top at the box office
mm-hmm.
for over a month now, between Shrek and The Karate Kid and now Toy Story. Like, we haven't had a family movie not at the top of the box office in over, like, 6 weeks. So it's really bizarre, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like,
yeah.
You could have essentially kind of predicted
that. With a slew of family movies.
True.
No, we did. I mean, we knew that the big movies this season would be. I mean, we always said this season Toy Story would own it. I mean, that's
what I said. We did say that, but the thing is, when Shrek came out, we had a conversation, and everyone had a conversation, where they said that Shrek's opening weekend was a disappointment. Everybody was like, wow,
right.
This is the end of the Shrek
yeah.
movies, because this movie didn't make as much as the other two. But what no one could have predicted was, in the following two weekends, it was still the lesser of all the other evils that came out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it had legs.
It did have legs. That surprised me.
As far as the rest of the summer goes, though, there's a lot of other kids' movies going. It'll be interesting to see if that trend continues.
Yeah, it's kind of all there's a when you go see Toy Story 3 or something, or you go see Shrek, you see these advertisers. You got this, you know, Despicable Me, Megamind. Everything's going to be in 3D. There seems to be just a lot of animated movies this year, more so than any other year that I can remember. And they're all going to be in some sort of 3D, just like that's what the summer looks like right now. There are obviously some of the live action stuff that we've talked about we want to see, but it does seem like an awful lot of animated movies,
all in 3D.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else special that you wanted to bring up, Chris, before we venture into our interview for the night?
Nothing I can think of. No.
Okay.
No.
Nah, pretty much done.
Well, no. Oh. I mean, there's. I could talk all night long, but there's nothing that leaps to mind. So,
right.
No.
Right.
You watched Disgrace and you loved it, huh?
I did watch Disgrace. I liked it very, very much. Malkovich is just such a watchable actor. You know,
mm-hmm, he is
one of those guys that you could just watch. Literally, read the phone book. I watched that. I watched Management again, which is, the Jennifer Aniston, Steve Zahn movie, which is, I think, really, really underrated. Like, it's
it
a very
is.
Sweet, very mm-hmm. sweet romantic comedy that I think a lot of people just sort of dismissed. And
which movie?
Management.
Highly,
highly underrated, very, very sweet and unpredictable kind of movie.
Mm-hmm. Chris is right. It is.
I recommend everyone watch that movie. Mm-hmm. Also,
I saw a movie I thought was underrated.
What was
it? You have the hots for Jennifer Aniston, yeah.
Big time.
Brooklyn's Finest.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
I want to see that.
There are moments in that movie that, especially, there are a couple of moments that remind you of the best kind of multi-plot lines and how they mm-hmm. intermingle them and they all kind of share this ever-escalating dramatic rhythm
right.
as you cut between one story and the next. There are great sequences like that in this movie. I think it's a far superior movie to Training Day, actually, where the only thing I really latched onto in Training Day was the same thing everyone else did, Denzel Washington's performance.
Right. I
disagree with that. I love that.
I like Training Day, but no, Brooklyn's Finest is very underrated. It's it will, regardless of what you think of the trailer, you think, oh, this is all run of the mill, but it's got those storylines are all very compelling. You're very invested in those characters emotionally. I do like Training Day, though. I like the Ethan Hawke and Denzel Washington's relationship. They had a very good dynamic in that.
Ugh.
Okay, I'm just saying. I mean,
I agree. I agree with you, Jerry. I know I'm in the minority. I agree that everyone latched on to Denzel Washington in that movie, and that's all anyone ever talks about. But I think the movie benefits from repeated viewings. Like
mm-hmm.
it's one of those movies that sort of like Sexy Beast. When I first watched it, all everyone was talking about was Ben Kingsley and how awesome he is in it. So that's what I responded to when I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
No,
you know where I benefit from repeated viewings of Training Day?
Where?
When I'm having trouble sleeping. There's just something that I have a problem with Ethan Hawke, but I really liked him in Brooklyn's Finest. Something clicked for me in Brooklyn's Finest. Also
hey,
knowing
you know
that
movie?
The original choice for Ethan Hawke's role in Training Day was Freddie Prinze Jr. So
yeah, I know.
Oh, wow.
So
that
awful.
Was, whoa, that was
oh, my God. I think he's working at a car wash on Hollywood Boulevard, by the way, right?
When is Scooby-Doo 3 coming up?
Oh, God. Hey, you know what movie you and I never talked about, Jamie, was Undyne.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
I thought it was fine. I thought it was good. I didn't necessarily like the look of it. I thought the look of it was kind of a little too...
washed out. Very washed
yes,
out.
Yes, yes. I enjoyed the magical realism of
yeah.
it. I enjoy Colin Farrell a lot.
How long until Colin Farrell gets a performance that sort of catches on with the mainstream public, or will that sort of never happen? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You and I have talked about it before. We've talked about it on the show before, too. Like, when he came out, it was sort of like he was the it boy with Tigerland, and I was like, that was sort of followed with Daredevil and a lot of shit like that. And I was like, what the fuck is everybody talking about? This guy's not that great. And then all of a sudden, the last couple years, there's been stuff like In Bruges and then Crazy Heart and now Undyne
yeah.
and maybe a couple other movies in there, too, that were also very good. And
he just keeps getting better.
Yeah, he sort of turned into one of these guys that is like, I mean, I don't want to put him in the category of anybody like Sam Rockwell or anything like that, but he's sort of turned into one of these good-looking leading men who I sort of look forward to now because he's got something else to bring to the table
yeah,
other than just a good look.
You get the sense, too, that he is always challenging himself.
Yeah, I like
that.
Yeah.
He wants to be a better actor.
The New World,
yeah.
I think, like, kind of like the turning point.
Yeah. Yes, good point. Yes, exactly. New World was the turning point for him.
Yeah.
But he was good. There's a movie he did, I think, I want to say Irish, I'm not sure, called Intermission, which was
yes.
good. Very good. But he played like a thug, but he was very good in that. He was good in there's another one, I know it's not very popular, At Home at the End of the World, that came out, I think, 2004. I liked him in that. That was different. But no, I think the New World really is this turning point for him.
Yeah. Just a great movie.
That was the best thing in Undyne.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, even though I don't like the film necessarily, I think he's great in Miami Vice. And, you know, obviously Cassandra's Dream.
Yeah, he was
a great
very good
performance.
At that.
Yeah. And so I'm looking forward to Fright Night and whatever else he does. And he's not afraid to go back and do these independents. You know?
Yeah,
he does these independent movies.
You know when you sign on to make Undyne that it's not going to be seen for
right.
the most part, unfortunately.
Right.
Like,
right.
it's really not going to be seen outside of Europe and a few, you know, people in the United States. Like, that movie's not going to be seen.
you're making it because you are interested in the character, you're interested in the story, you're interested in working with Neil Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, you know that that movie is not going to be, like, raking in the money. It's not going to be playing on a double bill at the drive-in next to Meet the Little Fockers. Like, it's not going to, it's just not going to happen. Like, you make that because you enjoy making movies.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're
well,
right.
Well, it sounds like something you put on a scrape. It sounds like an antiseptic. So, I mean, it's,
yeah.
What's a Mondain on
it? Sounds like either an antiseptic or a black girl's name. Like, you know.
or maybe both, which, you know,
yeah.
Lethal combination. Yeah, so, I mean, that's a good movie. And I have the Joan Rivers movie here, Chris, if you want to watch it.
I don't. Thanks, so.
He's honest, yes.
All right, then return my 20... You have my library. You have my DVD library at your house.
I've got I've got literally a shit ton of your movies. I got a
shit ton.
But you haven't seen The Crazies yet, have you, Chris?
I have not. I really, really want to, though. I wanted to see that movie. I'll have to watch it by myself because my wife hates horror movies. I almost said pregnant movies. She loves pregnant movies. Hates horror movies.
How's your wife doing with her pregnancy?
She's nauseous and tired all the time, and she never wants to fuck. What else do you want to know?
That's about it.
Yep.
Why do you think I'm doing the show?
Good point. There you go. That's as honest as we're gonna get.
Well, what a terrific segue into The Crazies. Let me tell you, Chris, you need to see this movie. This is a great film of this genre. Great performances, so well directed, really intense. And you know, when you think that this genre is tired out, it's refreshing to see an entry like this one. Breck Eisner, he also did Sahara. Armand White loved that.
Are you
hey,
really?
You know
he
what?
That?
Incidentally,
Armand White's side on that one. Like, I think that Sahara is one of the more enjoyable awful movies from McConaughey.
Man, we're selling this interview. But this is a great conversation. Actually, we had a new contributor to Movie Geeks United do this interview for us, Josh Youngerman, and he did a great job. So this is his debut on Movie Geeks United in this interview. Chris, thank you, buddy. It's been enjoyable as always.
Hey, thanks, guys. I had a lot of fun.
Likewise.
I'll talk to you tomorrow night.
Okay, man. See ya.
Bye, dude.
Bye.
All right. So you ready for this, Jerry?
Yes, I am. I'm very curious to hear this. So.
Alrighty. Here is Breck Eisner, director of The Crazies, which comes out on DVD this coming Tuesday, the 29th.
I don't care what the calendar says. Opening day. That's the first day of spring. So.
Whoa. What the hell are you doing?
Rory? You lay that gun down.
David, you took the right play. Would you mind taking a look at Bill?
Sure, what's wrong?
I don't know. He's just not right.
She worries too much. I'm fine.
You got any plans this weekend?
She worries too much. I'm fine.
Ben.
How long have you been playing a statue?
A couple hours now. Same look Rory gave me. We're in trouble.
Is he dead?
David, there's somebody outside.
The military started shooting town folks.
We gotta get out of here, guys!
All around me are familiar Michael Aguilar and Dean Gregoris, they had a production company at Paramount, and they had secured the rights from Romero directly for The Crazies. George actually still owned the rights, and so they optioned it from him and put him on as an executive producer, and they had a script written by Scott Kozar. That's the point that they brought me, that they sent me the script, and I came on to the onto the movie, although I had a significant kind of difference in opinion on the script than the original draft, and we eventually hired a guy named Ray Wright to do the next draft, and that's the draft that we made.
Now, what were your impressions when you first viewed Romero's original film?
Well, at first, you know, when I was approached about about remaking The Crazies, I immediately remembered having seen it as a kid. I think like a buddy of mine, George, I think it was, brought over the tape on Betamax way back, and we watched this bizarre, crazy movie called The Crazies, and probably watching the day where we watched five or six other movies. And the fact that I remembered the movie, I thought was a great sign to the idea of remaking it. I mean, it stuck in my brain. Obviously, the idea, the basic concept of the movie, and the fear that it could happen, and it could happen to me, was something that sat in my mind. And then I had these like vague memories of weird scenes, like a woman brushing the grass with a broom, and some other bizarre guy lighting himself on fire. You know, there were these like flashes of images that I remembered specifically from the movie. But you know, I went back and obviously rewatched the movie and saw that true. You know, it did have a really strong concept. It was a really interesting cautionary tale, and is a movie that to me felt ripe for a remake, given the day and the age that we're living in today.
Yeah, like what relevance did you feel like the material had to like today's climate specifically? Because obviously the original has a lot of relevance to the time it was made. What do you think its relevance was today?
Well, the original was made in 72, 73 in the shadow of Vietnam. Obviously, America at a war many people thought it shouldn't be involved in, and it was a time where the country was really strongly split, and there was unrest about the kind of the future of what this country was going to be. And that, by the way, sounds exactly like what was happening at the time we started developing and were making the movie. You know, we'd we'd entered one or two wars that, whether we, you know, debatable whether we should have been there, and the country is in, you know, desperately kind of split on between the right and the left, and it was a very similar time. So the interesting thing about the movie was that the commentary that Romero was making in 73 was very true, and is very true to the world that we live in today.
I guess this is a question more about horror movies, but a lot of these films have sort of a tendency to speak specifically to sort of our social and political climates of the day.
Yep.
In a very specific way. And where do you think the horror genre is today, and what do you think it's sort of speaking to?
Well, the best horror speaks to the social climate of the day. I mean, Rosemary's Baby in its day, which is one of my favorite all-time horror movies, was really in reference to the women's lib movement. And Romero's Crazies was obviously in reference to Vietnam and the country in a war that it shouldn't be in. And I think that it's not always one thing that horror relates to. I think there are issues within the grand issue that horror relates to today. But, you know, I think that it's hard, you know, to say what it's relating to today, what it's referencing today, because a lot of the horror that's being made is oftentimes horror that's about, making a buck, remaking a franchise that was successful, putting in a bunch of archetypical characters, and really trying to make money off of a movie that's not really a movie, but more of the concept. And that's the kind of horror movie that I'm not really a big fan of. You know, I like good movies. I like movies that have strong characters, that have character journeys of characters that change over the course of the movie, that evolve, that the plot influences the characters. And and growing up, you know, I was a big horror fan, of the movies that I was, you know, brought up on that I liked were things like Rosemary's Baby and The Shining, The Exorcist, The Omen, Carpenter's The Thing, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And those were movies that were, those were good movies. And they were good horror movies. So I think it's important to kind of try and get back to that if you're going to, you know, to try and talk about what the movies are going to be about.
Did you have any sort of conversations with Romero prior to the shoot? How involved was he in the
I didn't talk
film?
To him. Actually, I didn't talk to him at all until after the movie was wrapped. Romero, in optioning the rights to Paramount, Romero said, look, you know, I've made it once. I want you guys to do what you're going to do, and just show it to me when you're done. So we you know, we rewrote, we shot, edited. A couple months before he came out, I set up a screening for Romero to see it in Toronto, where he lives, and he screened the movie early in the morning, and I called him the next day, which was a very nerve-wracking call. I hate asking anybody what they think of a movie I did, and certainly asking George Romero what he thought of my remake was a terrifying call to make, but he was very positive and has come out publicly positive towards the movie, and it was a great relief. And then after that, he came out to L.A. for the Academy Awards, and we had a long four-hour dinner and drinks and hung out and just talked about our different experiences of making the movie The Crazies. It was great. He's an awesome guy.
One of the most memorable scenes for me was the car wash scene, the editing, the staging of those sequences was really effective. What was it like shooting that scene?
That scene was a nightmare to shoot, as you can imagine. I think we had budgeted 2 days, if I remember correctly, maybe three to shoot the whole thing or to shoot the interior, and we ended up, I think, we shot 4 days or 5 days, went over, and on a tight budget, a tight schedule, that was a problem, and I had to come out of other parts of the movie. But, you know, you have four actors in a moving car with water and soap and gunfire and breaking glass and explosions and stunt guys and a real car wash, a real functioning car wash. It is, and it's wet and cold, and it was a ton of work. Wow. And it was exciting because there were so many great angles to capture, but every shot took forever to set up and to get the equipment working and to control all the different spinners and the thing that pulls the car, and it was a very difficult shoot. We had three separate cop cars to use, one for the window, the seat in the back was angled differently so Becca could get pulled out the back, one that had removable glass, one that had an engine taken out so we could put the camera and a camera crew in the space where the engine had been, and they could shoot back towards the car, because we had to, anytime they were shooting out of the car, we had to tent it all in and waterproof it and put everybody in rain gear, and it was a tricky thing. We also had to bring in special heated purified water, because, you know, the thing about a car wash is it uses recycled water.
Mm-hmm.
That's why
yeah.
we were able to have the water still flowing, and it doesn't use clean water. It actually recycles its own water. And so the way the car wash is set up, we had to then bring a tank in and get fresh water so that we had clean water. And we actually shot the interior and the exterior were two separate locations. The exterior was a small crop dusting airport hangar that we kind of dressed to look like the car wash, and the interior was a real car wash. And then we built the end of the car wash. We modeled it after the real car wash and put it out in the field, so we had that kind of view out into the fields at the end of the car wash.
How much was filmed in Iowa, and how much, because I know you filmed it in Georgia and Iowa, which of the scenes were, did you film all the scenes that take place in Iowa on location?
The reason we shot in two places was weather. We had a time frame to make the movie, and in Iowa, it was too cold to be outside, we started shooting in March. So we shot all our interiors in Georgia, almost all of our interiors in Georgia. We shot the truck stop at the end was shot in Georgia. Any significant interiors were shot in Georgia, and a few exteriors, like there's a farm where Scotty McCall is shot, and Scotty McGregor, sorry, we had to change his name. We shot those in Georgia, and all the exteriors were shot in Iowa. So it was about, I'd say, two-thirds Georgia, a third Iowa.
The casting for a second, what was it like working with Timothy Oliphant and Rhoda Mitchell? And were they the two actors that you had in mind, or how did that happen?
Well, yeah, Tim Oliphant was a total asshole. No, I'm just kidding. He was he was great. He was he's an amazing actor, a really great guy. He's really funny, actually. He's an incredibly funny guy. But mm-hmm. but most importantly, he's passionate. I mean, he really was a passionate part of the film experience, and that passion like helps infect everybody in the crew. They, you know, no pun intended. They, you know, like mm-hmm. everybody takes from him and takes that energy and brings it to the movie. And he really, you know, he was a big part in getting this movie made. And he was the first and only person on my list to play David Dutton. And I was, you know, I've been a huge fan of his since Go. And I obviously love Ed Wood. And he's, you know, he's just a real actor, you know, and he's clearly a movie star, but he also has an everyman quality about it. And but most importantly, he's a real actor. And that was the idea in the casting for The Crazies. We wanted to get people who were actors, not just personalities. And so that was from the top down. So we started with Tim. Once we had Tim cast, we looked into casting his character's wife, and the perfect person for that was obviously Radha Mitchell. She's got great experience in genre movies like this, but she also does real dramas and is a real actress. And from there, we did a big search to find the character that played the deputy. And I think I must have auditioned 100-plus people, and Joe Anderson, who plays the character,
yeah,
Russell,
he's excellent.
Is amazing. He's clearly the standout of all the guys who could have played that role.
I had no idea he was British.
Yeah, isn't that funny? I mean, like, the crazy thing about the movie, it's a movie about the heartland of America, and our DP was Italian, barely spoke English. Our production designer is English, England English. Our Rod is Australian. Joe is English. You know, it's this, like, multinational crew, cast and crew to do this, you know, Americana film. And of course, rounding out the top four, it was Danielle Panabaker's excellent young actress.
Mm-hmm. Was there any thoughts about doing this film in 3D? Because we're seeing right now this huge 3D craze, and I've heard that Flash Gordon might be in 3D. I was wondering what your thoughts about 3D were, and was it ever a consideration about doing this one in 3D?
No, 3D was never a consideration for this movie. I don't think it. You know, obviously when we shot it, it was before the 3D craze really ignited. But even if we were starting to shoot today, I still wouldn't do this movie 3D. It should be a flat 2D
mm-hmm.
movie. That's the way it, you know, that's the way it wants to exist, and that's the way I wanted to shoot it. Look, for the right movies, 3D is great. You know, for Avatar, it worked, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the danger is that every movie becomes 3D only because of the financial benefits to the studio.
Mm-hmm.
There clearly are financial benefits to the pricing of 3D movies, but that's the wrong reason to decide to make a movie 3D. I think a movie has to be, first and foremost, it has to technically work right for the movie. It has to be the right kind of movie for 3D, and something like Flash Gordon, which, like Avatar, is an off-world adventure in 3D environments with CG characters, I think 3D would really enhance the movie-going experience. It helped transport the audience to this other world. I don't think, for me, Crazies would or should ever be 3D.
Now, about your upcoming projects, you have Flash Gordon, The Brood, and Escape from New York.
The Brood is, I guess on IMDb it says The Brood, but I passed on that movie. It was reported I was going to do it, but I'm not going to do it.
Okay, so what about Escape from New York and Flash Gordon?
Yeah, Escape from New York. Well, Flash Gordon I set up at Sony about a year and a half ago. It's a real passion project for mine. We've turned in the script, we've re-upped the option, and we're in continued development on that. But the studio is very aggressively interested in making it, but it's a long lead item, you know. Years of development and prep, and when design will happen before this movie sees the light of day. But, you know, this is a real passion of mine, and I will continue to work on it and to try and make it happen. It's, you know, the idea behind Flash Gordon is to go back to the strips, the Alex Raymond strips from the 30s
yeah.
and 40s. It's not in any way a remake of the 80s version. It's not camp. It's, you know, it's sci-fi
mm-hmm.
adventure off-world, and it's, you know, epic and exciting and could be a really phenomenal movie. And then a movie I signed on fairly recently, too, that is in advanced stages of final development is a remake of Escape from New York. And
mm-hmm.
That's one, that's at New Line, and that's one I'm hopeful that we can get the next polished draft in shortly and get into production on that, assuming we can find ourselves a fantastic Snake Plissken.
Yeah, like how long away do you think the Flash Gordon is of getting into production?
How long before it happens? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
In this day and age, who knows? But I know, you know, Flash Gordon is at least a year of prep. I mean, just to design
right.
the worlds and the creatures and all of that is at least a year. And I still have another, you know, I'd say 6 months of scripting to do. So it will not even be in production before a year and a half from now.
My final question is, you've worked in a lot of different genres, horror, sci-fi, action, adventure. There's a lot of diversity. Do you think that's sort of important? I heard Danny Boyle say that he sort of wants every film he makes to be his first film. And I guess, do you think that's an important thing?
Well, to me, I just love movies, and I love all kinds of movies. And there are guys out there who make one kind of movie and are amazing at it and can do that kind of movie probably better than I could. But being a fan of movies, if there's a good script and a good story and a good idea, I'll tackle it. It's exciting, you know. I mean, ultimately, I love genre movies. That's my passion. And whether it's sci-fi or any of the different sub-genres under sci-fi or horror or action or thriller or a mix of multiple genres, which I often love to do, I like genre movies. I think they allow you to do things with a wider audience that you could never do in a straight drama. You know, a good genre talks about society, talks about the world, and does it in a way that's entertaining, exciting, and also brings in a big audience. And that's the kind of movies that studios want to make today.
David, I'm not going to do this. I can't go to my parents.
You have no idea.
And neither do you. Look, whatever it is, I can't just leave. Are you going to leave?
I'm the sheriff.
I'm their doctor.
Yeah, well, if it turns out what they need is penicillin, I'll call you.
David.
What? What?
There's somebody outside.
All right, that's director Breck Eisner. The Crazies comes out on DVD and Blu-ray Tuesday the 29th. You can actually click on the link, the front cover of the DVD, and be sent to Amazon if you want to pre-order now. Do it, because it's a good movie.
It is.
I like
is
the movie.
Good. Yeah.
Thank you, Josh, for doing that interview.
Yeah, that was
for
a great interview. Thank you.
Good job. Good job. I was going to bring... Oh, our featured podcast of the week on our homepage from the archive is a tribute we did to Jaws maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. Because it's the 35th anniversary of Jaws this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right, dude. 35 years. Wow.
I was one.
I was four. I was four when that came out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good show. Man, like probably 10 guests on that show.
Yeah, oh, it's a ton of guests, man.
Carl Gottlieb, the biographer of Spielberg, Joseph McBride, Susan Baccalini, the woman that gets eaten in the very first scene.
That's right, yeah.
The Shark Is Still Working crew,
the
definitive documentary of the making of Jaws and the legacy of Jaws, and many more people in that show. Man, that was a jam-packed show.
That was.
Yeah.
That was a big deal. I remember that, yeah.
They don't make them like that anymore.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
And by they, I mean we. Anything else going on? Are you going to go see Night and Day this weekend?
I'll try. I'll definitely try to check it out. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see Cyrus. So,
are you going to see it during the night or day?
Probably the midday, mid-late day.
Right. Yeah, I always like to see like remains of the day about like 5:30, 6 o'clock.
Oh my God! Okay.
Twilight, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Red Dawn. All right, it's been a good one.
It has been. It's been are we going to be on Sunday? Are we coming back Sunday or?
I will be in Dallas.
Okay,
Sunday.
So no show Sunday. Okay.
We're coming back from so.
Okay, so next Wednesday night then we got.
Saul Rubinek.
Yeah.
You know him for movies like True Romance, Unforgiven, and he's coming on to talk about all those movies, plus
Warehouse 13, right?
Yeah, with the second season of his Sci-Fi Network show.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually talking about a TV show on Movie Geeks United.
Yeah.
That's a first.
Well, no, we've talked, remember we did a show about True Blood a couple of years ago, so.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. True Blood, have you been watching that?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. I'm curious to see where this season goes. The last episode was very interesting with the Nazi werewolves and everything, so I'm curious to see where they're going to go with this now.
Lots of crazy.
Mm-hmm. It is lots of crazy, yeah.
What do you think of the trailer for the new Scorsese show on HBO?
It's good. It's very promising. Speaking of Scorsese, it's very promising.
Yeah, yeah. They want another Sopranos hit. I mean, they got some good projects coming
up. They got some good projects, but I don't know. I don't know if they're ever... That's a hard thing to... Not so much the show, but to get that zeitgeist, to get something of that.
Yeah.
That's going to be hard to do.
You kind of can't.
You can't. It's impossible.
Set out to do that.
Who thought,
you know?
True Blood would be... No one
yeah.
thought True Blood would be... I mean, they thought at best a 2-season, but here we are now where they're going to 4th season after this, so it's
right.
really caught on, so...
Yeah, and even The Sopranos, everybody dumped that before HBO picked it up.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, so join us next week, Saul Rubinek, and more.
Yeah, sounds good, man.
We also have the
to talk about. There'll be a lot to
the
talk
direct,
about.
The directors of The Extra Man, which is the new Kevin Kline movie. We've got that in the vault, so
okay,
we can
cool.
pull that out, too. And you guys want to be around when we pull it out.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So we will see you guys next week. Should I end on a like mystery movie score?
Yeah, do a mystery movie.
Got so many of these. Oh, I actually uploaded some holding music.
Okay.
Like if there's ever a technical difficulty or we're waiting for someone to come on the line.
Yeah.
Here's our
okay.
Here's our holding music. You ready?
Yep.
Okay. Here it is.
Of course. Why does this surprise me?
Oh, that's great. I can't wait to play that. Okay. Let me choose a score here. All right. I got something. Thank you, dude. I'll talk to
Thank
you next
you.
Week.
All right, man. Have a good week. You know, have a good time this weekend, man.
Oh, I'm gonna do my darndest.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.